Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Hi, welcome to the Football Writers Podcast. My name's Mike Calvin. I'm joined by Dave Kidd of The Sun and Tom Hopkinson of The Sunday Mirror. Now, I remember the days when £142 million bought you a football club. Now, it buys you a footballer. A very good one in Philippe Coutinho, but the world's best? Not by a long chalk. We're getting to a stage, Dave, where money's meaningless.
It is, yeah. I think the Neymar transfer was so far off the scale compared to anything that had gone before it that we've gone into a completely different era. Coutinho, you know, if Neymar is worth £198 million, you can do algebra and maybe Coutinho's worth £142. I don't know. It's ridiculous to quantify it, really. But the fact is Barcelona wanted him that much and Liverpool wanted not to sell him that much. So that's the fee that was agreed. And when a player doesn't want to be at a club, and he clearly hasn't done for the last 6 months to a year, then it's inevitable that he is going to go. Barcelona and Real Madrid always get their man. It might not be in the first transfer window, but it's generally the second one, if not the first. And we'll see who they come for next from the Premier League. Maybe Harry Kane, who knows? But and again, that will be £300 million probably if that happens. So yeah. There we go.
Where are we getting with this, Tom? Because it was obvious that Coutinho wasn't happy. You know, we now know that he actually told his teammates he wanted to go. And when you do that, you cross a line, don't you?
You do, yeah. But I think there's a line of respectability as well. And Coutinho has stayed very much, for me, on the right side of that. I think every footballer, as every employee in whatever line of industry you choose to work in, has the right to go to their employer and say, I've been offered another job and I'd like to leave. Now, look, he signed a contract at the club. They've held him to it. And he has done very well. I mean, I've seen Coutinho over the years and I've thought he was a good player. I've seen him quite a bit this year and I now think he's an exceptional player. He's really impressed me with what I've seen of him this year. But it's his work ethic that I like. He's not done the Virgil van Dijk or not taken that route, you know, the moody photos on Facebook or Instagram, whatever it is.
Staring off into the middle.
Staring off towards Merseyside from Southampton. You know, he's not done that and he's... Look, he obviously had the little bit of a sulk in the summer when it was going on. He had the bad back. But when he came back, you know, the agreement was clearly there. Look, give us a few months, give us 4 months. As long as we get the right money for you, we'll let you go, we'll be happy. But you have to keep your side of the bargain. And he's done that. So I've got no problem with, you know, Kiddo and I worked together, you know, a few years ago. I'd have had no problem with him coming and saying, I've been offered a better job, I'm off, but I'm going to stay and help you all out. And you know, and as long as he keeps doing the job, you know, it doesn't make the rest of you work a lot harder, which I probably would have done to him.
He's beyond price. Anyway,
of course, yeah. £140 million journalist. But that's the point. I think he's kept his side of the bargain. And I think that's why, you know, if you're a Liverpool fan, yes, you'll be upset. But I think ultimately you wave him on his way and say, you know, you're leaving us to go to Barcelona. You're leaving us to go to the joint biggest team in the world. So, you know, best wishes and hope it works out.
Definitely, that's what they are saying, though, to be honest.
No, I don't think they're happy, are they? But there we are. The money suggests that he's the third best player in the world. Where do you think his true rating is?
Possibly top 10, but certainly not top 3. But no, he's a very good player. But they have got, you know, a lot of good attacking options already. They've got. Clearly, Salah's been an outstanding signing. Mane and Firmino, and obviously they're after another one now. So the thing with Klopp is that he, at Dortmund, he's very used to this. His best players have been sold and he's got on with it, and he's built another team and he's replaced them because he's a good manager, he's a good coach, and he's very used to it. When you've been at Borussia Dortmund, most of your best players end up at Bayern Munich, or, you know, certainly these days. So, you know, it's not something that he hasn't dealt with before. He's had 6 months to prepare himself mentally for this happening, and to work out who they're going to replace him with. Be that maybe Mahrez or others.
I'm not sure he's top 10, you know, because he's not yet done it in the later stages of the Champions League. He's not yet done it, you know, at the really top level of football. And he's now getting that opportunity. So, yeah, one day he probably will be top 10. But I think for now there are still a lot of players who, you know, would fit into that category ahead of him.
Mm. Who do they get to replace him?
It's interesting. I mean, Lamar is the main shout. I think £100 million being touted for him. Quite a direct player.
But that's probably going to be the summer?
We'll see. I mean, it depends. It depends how desperately Liverpool decide they want him. I mean, Mahrez is the other shout, isn't it? And look, both Monaco and Leicester will be looking at that, saying, right, we know how much money you've got to spend, so show us the colour of it, and then show us the colour of some more of it, and you can probably have him now. I agree with Dave. They've got some very good attacking players. I think they've got enough. They're not going to win the league this season. I think they've got enough with Adam Lallana coming back, with Oxlade-Chamberlain filling in as well alongside Salah and Mane. I think they've got enough to get them into the Champions League this year. So it may be that they choose to wait for Lamar, but I also think Mahrez... I know Liverpool have been quite strong in saying, you know, we're not in for him, but I do think that wouldn't be the worst signing at all, actually, as a replacement for Coutinho, because he's probably a bit more like for like than Lamar is.
Mm. Neither of those, for me, are sort of nailed on to succeed. But Mahrez is someone who's...
Neither was Coutinho, was he, either?
Nor was Suarez, really, weren't there. You can't be sure, can you? But Mahrez has tended to flit in and out of seasons, really, you know, with Leicester. And most of those Monaco players from that great team last year who've come over here, a couple of those haven't done very well at all. It takes a while to adjust, so... I'm not sure which one.
There's almost like a new phenomenon around at the moment where you've got this sort of semi-detached player. You've got a guy under contract, but he knows where he's going to be in the summer. So Emre Can's a good example. You know, he's got this 5-year deal on the table for Juventus. Similarly with Naby Keita. Human nature is he wants to get to Liverpool as fast as he can. Do you think Liverpool might try and accelerate that process?
It's possible. I don't know exactly the exact exactitudes of that agreement they made in the summer with Keita, but I mean, we certainly had last summer a real trend for clubs holding on to players who agitated for moves, including Coutinho, Van Dijk and Barkley. It didn't last long, did they? They've all gone already in the first few days of January. You can only really keep a dissatisfied player for so long, and it's never going to be perfect. And you know, you wonder whether clubs are better off just selling straight away, because they're never going to get, I don't think. I mean, whatever you say about Coutinho, and he certainly hasn't downed tools over the last few months, I still don't think you're getting absolutely 100% out of a player once his mind's elsewhere.
I think World Cup year, the clubs see World Cup year as being slightly different, don't they? They realise that there's the carrot at the end of the season, and that players, you know, they can't just throw the towel in, you know, totally. You might get 90%, 95%, whatever. They still have to perform to show their national team manager that they deserve their call-up, that they warrant the call-up. So I think... But Alexis Sanchez, of course, is the other one, and Arsenal. I don't care what any Arsenal fan would tell me, they are not getting total commitment from
him. Because he's distraught that Chile haven't qualified.
Well, and more because he was distraught, I think, that he didn't get his move to Manchester City in the summer.
What about the current makeup of that Liverpool side? Are they the ones capable of ending Manchester City's unbeaten run at Anfield on Sunday?
They are capable, certainly, yeah. It's a tough game. It's probably the tougher game of City you're going to have the rest of this year, the way they can counter-attack teams. And City have not got a great defence. And people talk about them being the greatest Premier League of all time. They're not the most well-balanced. They're possibly the most eye-catching, most exciting and entertaining. They're not the best, not the most complete. And City have got those weaknesses, and Liverpool could exploit them. But then again, Crystal Palace could have exploited them. City won't go the whole season unbeaten, I don't believe. We saw against Palace, you know, a penalty kick away from losing that one against a side in the bottom half. So they won't be that consistent. Even Guardiola admits that won't happen.
I think it's arguably the most balanced game that Manchester City will face, because where Manchester City have flaws, which, to be fair, they've addressed a lot of them in terms of the defence this season, Liverpool have got those flaws as well. Now, We see with Virgil van Dijk coming in, he obviously hit the ground running with the goal and in the game against Everton, and quite a decent performance all round from him as well. But I think, you know, we've got two sides who are exceptional to watch going forward. But as Dave says, there are flaws at the back and areas that, you know, areas of weakness that that can be a way can be found through them.
So be a lot of goals in that game.
It could be.
I was very impressed with Van Dijk. You know, okay, we said earlier on about the, you know, doing his Heathcliff on the Moor impression. But actually, if you look at that, what really impressed me was the leadership quality that he showed. He was talking to people, directing the goalkeeper. Mm. Liverpool have got the missing link there, haven't they?
They would hope so, and for £75 million, I think he has to be the missing link. You know, whatever we say about money almost being irrelevant now, you know, there are still huge, significant sums, and you know, you have to perform if you're going to be one of these players who is transferred for anything over £30 or £40 million these days. Again, sounds crazy that you're thinking you can buy a player for less than that, and he doesn't have to justify it. But you know, he was very impressive. Communication. I mean, you know, look, never for a minute question his on-field ability and his leadership skills. But I didn't particularly like the way he went about things when it didn't work out for him in the summer. But he looks like he could be that man that they've been crying out for.
Yeah. If we talk about natural leaders, Dave, what about Vinnie Kompany at Manchester City? Injured yet again. But I thought, you know, he's just done his MBA degree, talked about the need for much more realistic ticket pricing. Mm. I looked at that and I thought, there's a manager or a chief exec of the future.
Yeah, it could well be a chief exec, possibly, yeah. He's a very, very bright man. He's got a great, you know, it's quite rare, but it does happen that you get a player come from overseas and have a bond with a club which is as strong as anyone who is, like, you know, born in East Manchester. You know, he really is part of the fabric of that club. I'm sure City will value him, and he'll work in whichever way he wants. But I don't really... He won't want to jack it in yet. I think he's 31, 32, I think. He's not at the age where he'll want to jack it in yet. I think he'll keep going, they'll keep patching him up, and when he is fit, he'll still contribute, because they still haven't quite replaced him, have they, I don't think. Mm. Even though Otamendi's improved and Stones has improved, they still a fully fit Kompany would still walk into that side. So there's still some time to go before he dons the suit, either in the dugout or in the boardroom.
I'd love to see him go to FIFA, something like that. You know, I think FIFA as an organisation...
Would you wish that on your worst
day? No, to be fair, that's a good point. But you know, I think there's a real opening now for people like Vincent Kompany, who've played the game at the highest level, but are bright, articulate, you know, will think about the game in a way that people who haven't played it can do as well, but also bring, as you say, they've got the educational expertise as well, having done qualifications like that. I think there's a real opening for people like him, so I think it'd be great to see FIFA embracing players like Kompany when they finally do retire.
Mm. And another broader issue, Dave, does anyone really care about the League Cup anymore? I know, you know, we're in semi-final week.
Probably
two
not.
Legs.
Probably not. If you started football all over again from scratch, you wouldn't invent the League Cup. I mean, we've got the FA Cup. We don't really need the League Cup. It's not just the big clubs who see it as an inconvenience. It's the Championship clubs as well. It's for, you know, possibly even the League One and League Two clubs see it as an inconvenience. I don't really see the point of it. The fact is, it's built into TV contracts. You'd have to find the right time to scrap it. I think inevitably it will be scrapped at some point. No one, it doesn't really get anyone's juices flowing. I think the teams who make the semi-finals, because it's two-legged, you know, it really becomes a pain, because I know obviously Chelsea ended up in a replay, and Conte's thinking, well, I've now got every midweek in January we're playing a game now. All four midweeks Chelsea are playing, so twice a week, every week. It's straight after a very, very busy Christmas period.
It does beg the question, doesn't it, Tom? Should you just say, well, OK, let's have a semi-final one-off hit, and secondly, no more replays in the FA Cup?
Yeah, I mean, to address the League Cup issue first, I think, yeah, why do you need two-legged semi-finals? You know, it probably even makes the competition a little bit more interesting, because let's say a smaller side gets to the semi-finals, then on a one-off game, 90 minutes, they've probably got more of a chance against one of the big boys than they have.
Well, you look at it, if Manchester City, say, win 4-0 against Bristol City on Tuesday night,
yeah,
who's really bothered about the next week?
Absolutely points. I mean, look, I think the competition still holds, you know, for supporters if their team gets to the final. Mourinho was always very good. You know, he always said, look, it's still a trophy, I want to win it, and probably not just because he wants to buy a watch to celebrate winning it as he does with all his silverware. But, you know, I still think there is a place for the competition. But, you know, as Dave says, it has to be watered down a bit, or as you said, with the replays. FA Cup replays... I'm still a bit torn on this. It was something we put to Arsene Wenger on Friday at his press conference, and he said that he was very much for replays to stay because, you know, he's...
He did have one yesterday.
That was the point he made. He said there have been many times when I would have, you know, taken a replay over the result we actually got. We've got the squads to be able to deal with it. You know, maybe we need to look at it another way. Let's say that teams can have squads of 30 now rather than the 25, you know, if that's what the gripe is, that they haven't got enough players to cope with it, then let's open it up and make sure they have got the number of players to cope with it. I think for me, the whole festive fixture list has come under immense scrutiny over the last couple of weeks, but I think as long as teams are playing on the same day, I don't think it matters how many games there are, because, I mean, Dave and I, you know, both known Jimmy Greaves for a number of years now, and he would have told us many times about the games when they play on Boxing Day and then they play the next day.
Christmas Day, absolutely.
You know, and I know even going back to the 90s, there were games on sort of the 27th and there'd be a game on the 28th. So players can cope with it. I think, you know, the only time that fixture congestion starts to become an issue is when teams have... One team will have 5 days to recover and another team will have 2 days to recover.
I'd get rid of FA Cup replays myself. I think it makes it less likely you get a shock. I think I went through it. There's been about once or twice in the last 15 years that a Premier League club has been knocked out by a lower league club in a replay. If you had a penalty shootout, you know, I was at Shrewsbury West Ham Sunday, and even Paul Hurst, the Shrewsbury manager, who might have been really looking forward to going to the London Stadium for a replay at a big venue, said, no, I'd rather have finished it on the day. I'd rather have had extra time penalties. He knew his team would have had a better chance, less congestion with the fixture list, and more of a chance to get another payday in the fourth round. So I don't even think the smaller clubs that are supposed to, apart from maybe the people who are counting the money, apart from, you know, the actual managers at smaller clubs aren't necessarily in favour of replays.
Give us a reminder about what it's like to be in a ground when there's an upset. You know, you were at the new Gay Meadow yesterday.
Yeah.
What did that mean? What was the feeling like in the crowd?
Real occasion, real sense of occasion, absolutely. I mean, actually, Joe Hart added to it because he was the hometown boy coming back and he got a great reception from the home fans. But, there is that real buzz about it. I mean, and we go to the game, you try and pick one that might be a shock every third round, and more often than not, it doesn't come off. But when they do come off, it's fantastic. There's a real sense of community there, the whole town pulling together at Shrewsbury. You know, big club, big names coming in. Moyes, who actually played there as well as a player. Everything around the match was excellent, but the actual match itself on that occasion didn't quite live up to it. So
Yeah. Talk of not living up to a certain responsibility, Arsenal. Is that the worst defence of the FA Cup ever?
No, I would imagine probably not. But I mean, look, Forest are a big old club, a grand old club with plenty of tradition and history. So they're always in with a chance on an occasion like that at the City Ground, you know, when it's packed. It'll be a great atmosphere. It's a difficult place for any team to go. But I have to say, I've got a certain degree of sympathy with Arsene Wenger on this one, because he picked a side. I think it was 9 internationals. They were well capable of beating a young Nottingham Forest team, albeit
some very, very good young players.
Very, very good young players.
Brereton,
yeah. I mean, Brereton's sort of been on our radar for a little while. Matty Cash as well is another player who we've heard his name.
Worrell at the back.
Around. Worrell at the back looked good as well. So, but you know, this goes back to the point. Arsenal still had a team yesterday that were capable of winning that game. I think the players just let Wenger down, absolutely. I know some people will say he should have picked a stronger side, he should have respected Nottingham Forest and their traditions and a championship team more than he did, but I would lay the blame squarely at the door of the players for that one.
Mm. Can't defend, can they? They just can't defend. No. What's Steve Bould doing? He was supposed to sort that out, wasn't he? Mm. They can't defend.
Where does this leave Wenger?
Same as he has been for the last 10 years. Nothing's going to change. He says maybe we'll review it after 1 year of this current 2 year, you know, at the end of this year. They've not won the FA Cup. Say they get beat by Chelsea in the League Cup, which we'd imagine they probably would. They don't even get in the top four in a year when all the rest of the top six have all gone into the Champions League knockout stages, Arsenal got the distinct advantage of, they're not bothered about the Europa League, they've got the distinct advantage of not having to focus any other focus. If they don't make the top four, and at the moment it doesn't look likely, then that's been a season of complete and utter failure. Mm. They've got key players who don't want to be there, but they keep hold of them just out of stubbornness. They've got a defence that can't defend. They've got coaches. They've got a bloke who's come in to supposedly sort the defence out. They can't even defend a free kick. They can't even know what the offside rule is. The way they gave away the penalties was embarrassing. The whole club's a complete shambles.
Apart from that.
It's
all well there. Yeah. I mean, and given the fact that competition has been in Wenger's insurance policy for the last few years, I mean, I was...
Three out of four,
Surprised that he didn't play. Mm.
They're going to do a Man United and just concentrate on the Europa League, aren't they?
They have to.
Could do with Jose double, couldn't they? Obviously, the League Cup and the Europa League.
Have to.
With that, Dave has already said you think that Chelsea will beat Arsenal. Do you agree with that?
I do, yeah. I do. I think they've got a manager who's spoiling for a fight at the moment. I think he'll be absolutely energised and revved up for a couple of clashes against another one of his so-called Big Six rivals. And I think they have got an attack who can cause an Arsenal defence, whether it's the first string Arsenal defence or the second one, serious problems. I think Eden Hazard looks in good form at the moment. Morata, his confidence looks a little bit low, but it's only going to take, the old proverbial one off the backside and he'll be back on form. So, yeah, I would expect Chelsea, and particularly with their defensive capabilities as well, I would expect them to come out on top over two legs. But I think it'll be a good game. I think it'll be a couple of good ties.
That was a really good league game last week. I was at that for 2-2. Yeah. It was a really good game, actually. Yeah. And Arsenal, funny enough, everything I've said, they've played well against Chelsea over the last sort of year or so.
There was an intensity about it, wasn't it, which
you don't normally see from Arsenal.
It was a really good game of football, actually, Arsenal-Chelsea. It was ding-dong. It was very end-to-end. Two teams really going for it. And then also, Arsenal actually went to Stamford Bridge earlier this season and played for a really good 0-0, actually. And they beat them last season. They beat them in the cup final. Chelsea bullied Arsenal for many years. And actually, at the moment, under Conte, they're not bullying Arsenal. So it should be a good game. I still think Chelsea will win.
Mm-hmm. Where do you see Ross Barkley fitting in there?
Barkley's a quality player without doubt, but he hasn't progressed whatsoever. And it's what the interesting thing is whether he's going to be, well coached there. Given that we assume Conte's probably not going to be at Chelsea next year, it may well depend who comes in because he's not fit at the moment. I don't know when he's due to be fit. Do you know, Tom?
He's been training on his own, so that tells us it's probably going to be a couple of weeks away.
I don't think actually we'll see Barkley playing a lot of football this season, starting an awful lot. I think he's an excellent signing for the price. If someone can get hold of him and get the best out of him and get him thinking about his football more, because his natural gifts are, and he's a big fella as well, by the way. He's talented. He's also got strength and he's got so many attributes. But I want to see a manager get hold of him. And probably he probably plays as a number 10, like that would be his best position.
I think when Mauricio Pochettino was looking at him in the summer as well, he fancied him for the right hand side of that attacking midfield three. That was very much the position that he was selling to Barkley. Yeah. And I don't see him going to Chelsea and fulfilling that role. No.
I think at Spurs it might have worked for him.
But yeah, I agree with Dave. I think maybe with him and Fabregas, the rotation going in there, or two playmakers when in the games that you need them. But I have to say, look, I know Bakayoko is coming for a lot of stick. I still think maybe next year we might see a huge improvement from him. And there's been niggling injuries this time, haven't there, from him? But I think with sort of three central midfielders in those three that we've just talked about, I think Chelsea's midfield looks fairly strong.
Mm. Yeah. Tom mentioned Conte's tour de force in front of the cameras. Where are we going with these managerial feuds, the Mourinho-Conte?
This one's been particularly ridiculous, isn't it? I mean, it's been...
You're a clown. Demented.
You're a clown, right. You're senile, you're a match fixer, you're little.
I mean, it is a fake. You missed the fake out.
It is. It really is, primary school playground stuff. It's ludicrous. In some ways, these sort of feuds, you know, we as tabloid journalists, all newspaper journalists, like them. You know, at certain times, certain days,
if there's a can of petrol around, we'll throw it on the flame.
Yeah, to some extent. But this one's been particularly puerile, and actually, funnily enough, the last day or two of it, it's not got as much. People in newspaper offices are thinking, getting bored with this, because this one's got nothing to do with what
we know about this. I mean,
it's just petty insults, isn't it? It's not even quite often. Quite often it is actually based on a footballing issue, and there's a genuine something to get your teeth into. There's nothing really to say about this apart from it's just two grown men acting like 7-year-olds.
Puerile, petty, 7-year-olds. But for me, long may it continue. I've really enjoyed it. You know, because it's we live in this day and age where there are so much of football is washed down and it's boring because. Press officers and agents and managers won't let human beings express an opinion, and it's just making it dull, it's diluting it. We're getting back to, at least for a week or so here, we're getting back to days when people, you know, have an opinion. They don't like each other. Brilliant. It doesn't matter that they don't get on. Let them have it out. You know, that's great. I just think let's sit back and enjoy it. And I would imagine that there are many people, many football fans are watching it and listening in. I mean, for a manager to bring up the match fixing situation with Antonio Conte is, and it's to Mourinho's credit, it's something that the media over here, we probably should have asked him about.
He was asked about it at the start when he first got the job, actually. Yeah,
but it wasn't really pressed hard on it. It was a huge story that it's almost like, okay, well, tap dance around it, and Mourinho hasn't. So I'm more for, you know, I think supporters will understand it and appreciate it more if there are more opinions in the game.
I actually agreed with his initial opinion. I actually don't often agree with Mourinho, but I think the thing about when he's talking about clowns. What he actually said as well was, he said, just because I'm not acting like a clown doesn't mean I haven't got passion.
That was also a veiled dig at Klopp, wasn't it?
Yeah. But I don't like this idea, which has become a bit of a truism that people keep saying, you know, is that, you know, unless a manager is showing passion, i.e. going berserk on the touchline, that each time he doesn't care, that's nonsense. I mean, they are playing for the cameras. I mean, Klopp and Conte, there is a certain amount of that in it. So I think his actual initial point that Mourinho made was actually a really fair one. Mm.
What about Arsene Wenger and all this? He's got like a permanent place on the FA's naughty step, hasn't he?
Yes, at the moment, yeah. And he's got away with a lot of it over the years, hasn't he? You know, I mean, that's been one of Mourinho's other gripes, that Arsene Wenger has been in the clear when he, you know, he hasn't for lesser outbursts. But, I think, again, there can be a degree of sympathy with Wenger over the decisions that have gone against his side. You know, I think both of the penalties they'd fall into that I've seen them given category, which, you know, is never totally the basis that a penalty should be given on. He said his piece, and I don't think he should have been quite as inflammatory as he was about it. You know, there's probably a better time and place to do it, but for me, it's just... I don't mind it either. I think at least they're speaking their mind, and long may that continue.
What about refereeing standards, Dave? How bad are they?
I don't think they're as bad as people crack them up to be. We're now going to have a VAR system introduced that's going to make things an awful lot worse, in my opinion. It's going to lead to long delays and different people guessing from a studio in Hounslow which would take away so much from the essence of the game. It's almost become accepted that our referees are lousy, therefore we have to impose this system on the game that's going to totally change, you know, a game that's been massively popular worldwide for 150 years, and we're going to have to change the complete nature of it because these blokes aren't up to it. And they actually are. They do get a lot right. I thought the West Brom one was a very poor one, a very, very unusually bad one. It's not that often that you get an absolute clanger. And the West Brom penalty decision, you know, I sympathise with Wenger on that one. But the vast majority of these are ones you could give either way, and they will be looking at them for 5 or 10 minutes, and we'll all be standing there freezing cold, not knowing what's going on, waiting for some other bloke in a studio in Hounslow to guess whether it was a penalty or not.
And still disagree. Some people disagree.
And we'll all still disagree.
And I think, you know, look, I don't think refereeing standards now are any worse than they were 10 years ago, 20 years ago, as they said, 150 years ago. There's more cameras.
Exactly.
There's more cameras. There's more social media. There's more cameras. We can all pause. You know, 20 years ago, we'd watch telly and we'd go, well, I think you made a mistake there. And you'd talk to whoever was next to you on the sofa and you'd discuss it. Oh, no, I disagree. Now, we pause it, we rewind it, we watch it. Oh, hang on, check that again, do it again. All the while, the game's still going on, and the poor ref, the man who's actually had to make the decision, hasn't been, you know, hasn't had the ability to watch it. Now, I still don't think we need VAR. I, as Dave said, I think it's taken away from the essence of it, and I still think it will leave as many decisions there to be argued about as we've got now. Maybe it might, you know, might clear up two or three extra every month or so, but I don't think it'll make too much of a difference. But it's just the advent of TV and social media.
Mm. We watch an awful lot of games, you know, you more than most, probably, Dave. You were at that 2-2 with Chelsea. Now, I try and trust my instinct on penalties, you know, the first thought. And I thought when Bellerin basically volleyed Hazard, I thought that was a stonewall penalty.
Definite penalty.
There was a massive debate.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it was, yeah. But mainly because Hazard made a meal of it. He did make a meal of it, but it was still a penalty. And, you know, that's what I thought anyway, but, you know.
Has players got a responsibility?
Well, yeah, but that's a game that's longer. I mean, again, we were talking about our old mate Jimmy Greaves. He says every footballer's a cheat, you know. And that's 50 years ago. Every footballer cheats all the time. No. It's not a new thing.
The
idea is there's some foreign thing. Greavesy will tell you, won't he?
Yeah.
Every footballer is a cheat. Well, you cheat all the time in every match.
You think about when we all used to play, you know, and everyone listening, every football fan, when they played as a child, you know, you go in for a tackle, the ball cannons off two of you, it goes out for a throw, you both put your hand up. It's intrinsic with the game, unfortunately. Yeah. And, you know, I'm not saying it's right, but it's just, it's not that happens at Sunday morning level. You can bet your life when there's more money involved at senior professional level, it's going to happen a lot more there. Mm.
Hugely pressurised world for football managers. Mark Hughes sacked by Stoke. Fair enough?
Yeah, it ran its course, hadn't it? I thought it was quite bold when Hughes went in there and tried to change the whole nature of that football club, that team which Pulis built and did so well in terms of establishing them in the Premier League, playing a certain way, and they became a cliche of the cold, wet Tuesday night at Stoke was because of the way they played so physically. He brought in a lot of, you know, pretty big-name European players. They for two or three years, he did sort of improve things, but not enough, and they didn't kick on into that sort of challenging for Europe where you might have expected them to a couple of years ago. Then it's all gone backwards, I think, over the last season and a half. Just, you know, that sort of that whole project seemed to die a death. That, you know, players suddenly were leaving, your Bojans, people like that, Arnautovic. And then suddenly this year, it didn't have an identity, did it? We didn't know where they were going with it. The timings didn't work. And you know, 4.5 years at one club in the Premier League is an awful long while these days. You know?
Well, that's a good thing, though, isn't it, Tom? At least that club have got a recent history of backing their managers. Mm-hmm. So it's an interesting and probably attractive appointment. Gary Rowett was doing very well at a club that you know well, Derby County. He looks
not that well, Stoke. keep him away.
But yeah, he's doing well at Derby. Yeah. Is he the sort of manager, British, who needs that Premier League opportunity?
Yeah, and I'd like to think he might get it in the summer after a glorious second place finish in the Championship, because Wolves are easily going to win that league. But yeah, I mean, look, I think we'd all love to see Gary Rowett, Lee Johnson. You know, there's so many names in the lower leagues, or the three tiers below the Premier League, I should say, who deserve an opportunity. And you know, even Sean Dyche, who is proven year after year now in the Premier League, is still not getting the opportunities to go on and manage, you know, the really big clubs in that division. So I still think, unfortunately, we're in a situation where British managers almost have to take clubs to the Premier League to be given a chance. And particularly when you see the likes of Marco Silva coming into Hull and then Watford and doing well enough.
Well, one got relegated, the others can't win.
Yeah, but look, I mean, he did. He certainly improved Hull even though he couldn't keep them up. They played better football. They made a better fist of it than they were doing under Mike Phelan. Watford, it's gone off the boil a little bit after the Everton. It's gone off the boil a lot after the Everton situation, Rosie said. But he's clearly got something, you know. There's clearly something in his armoury. So, yeah, I mean, would I like to see an English manager get it? Yes. Not Gary Rowett. But I wouldn't be surprised if Stoke didn't, you know, look overseas. And I think it's actually an attractive club for whoever comes in, because, as you say, they've got a very good owner. They've got a very wealthy ownership as well. And they clearly back their managers. But the one other point I'd like to make on this is, well, it's all part of the cityfication of football, if you like, that everyone has to play this certain style of beautiful Pep Guardiola-style football. And I don't think they do. And I think the Premier League's losing out because, you know, look, Tony Pulis's style, it's not always easy on the eye, but it was mightily effective, you know, and had Stoke finish in really good positions year after year. And all of a sudden they want to change it, and it's backfired on them. So, I say to clubs, look, if you can, just play the way that makes you successful and you'll win more games than you lose.
Yeah, that's easier to say if you don't have to watch it every week. If you're actually having to sit there and watch a Pulis team or an Allardyce team every week.
You say that.
You must see it occasionally. I know, but if you've got to sit there week after week and watch a Pulis team or an Allardyce team,
but isn't that the same for...
After a year or two,
Isn't that the same for every football team, though, really, you know, outside...
You want to go and enjoy the match. Don't you want to see your team playing well? You don't want to see them. You don't want to...
Yeah, but, you know...
Is that why Sam Allardyce's honeymoon period at Everton is officially over?
Well, at Everton, I mean, the traditions of that football club, it's such a backward appointment. It had a predictable short-term lift, but they were never going to go down anyway, Everton. You know, they started to turn it around even before he was appointed. So, I mean, the idea that Everton supporters want to sit there for the next 3 years and watch that, it's nonsense.
Don't agree?
I agree that Everton supporters probably don't, and this is, you know, I'm not being disrespectful to
Stoke. After
Stoke
have established themselves, then at that point they want something a bit more. They want to actually try.
Well, but I remember going to Stoke and seeing Peter Crouch score an incredible volley against Manchester City. Roberto Mancini used to say, you know, every time they went to Stoke, they had a really tough game, and it was tough. It was good. It was exciting to watch.
Now, but there were times when we went to West Brom, when you turn up at the Hawthorns, you do it with a very, very heavy step because. You knew what was going
to
come.
But what we're saying is you have to go and watch your team, and every single Saturday they have to perform brilliantly. They have to play tiki-taka football. They have to play the passing game. They have to pass out from the back. You know, it doesn't have to be like that. I mean, one of the games the weekend, I can't remember which one it was now, but, you know, the team who have been on a good run didn't get a great result, and there's booze, and you think to yourself, you know, we're in that time now where, you know, why can't people just say, well, we didn't play that well this week? You know, that's what used to happen. Good days and bad days.
Yeah. Everton are at Spurs in the BT Sport game this weekend. I thought it was interesting Pochettino talking about, look, we can't take Harry Kane for granted.
They can't, because Real Madrid are probably going to bid £300 million for him next summer if they can afford that. And, you know, well, they're certainly going to come in for him, and that's the sort of... They're going to know...
You think that's
well.
Realistic?
They certainly want him, and they want a centre-forward, and he's the best available out... Well, not available, but that might be available to them. You know, he's probably the best actual old-school number nine in the world, I'd have thought. You know, Lewandowski might be the other one, maybe, but I'm not sure if he might be slightly... past his peak. I think in terms of someone they could actually get their hands on, that they tried Lewandowski in the past, I think Kane's probably, you know, Benzema's not been pulling up any trees this year. He's their sort of, you know, genuine number nine. I know obviously Ronaldo and Bale can play as a number nine, but I think Pochettino's absolutely right, and he knows full well that Kane has got a great attitude, and there's a lot of truth in the fact that, you know, in the idea that he has real uncommon loyalty towards Tottenham. He does, but that's only still going to stretch so far if Real Madrid come in and make it apparent that they want to sign him and they will pay a world record fee for him, which they clearly would have to. So, you know, Pochettino is correct. They do need to up his wages. The Tottenham players don't get paid the market rate, and that's going to, at some point for each of them, there's going to be a pull away from the club.
Mm. Yeah, you did the piece with Danny Rose, and you know him well. he had to make that stand, didn't he? I had sympathy for him, to be honest.
Yeah, I mean, he didn't have to, but, I was glad that he did. But, he spoke very honestly about it, and he certainly wasn't the only one in that dressing room who thought the same thing. A lot of other Spurs players were patting him on the back. I don't think Kane necessarily was. I don't think Kane was particularly a massive opinion either way about it. A lot of Spurs players totally agreed with him and would have said the same thing. Kane wasn't one of those, I would say. He's certainly not going to be agitating at the moment for a move, but... If you're on 100 grand and you're suddenly going to be offered 400 grand a week and, going to be number nine for the most famous club on the planet and they're willing to pay a world record fee for you, I don't think there's anyone in the world who would think, oh, actually, no, thank you very much. I'll stick on my current money at Spurs and see if we can maybe finish fourth and not win a trophy ever.
Will they finish fourth? Will they get in the top four?
Well, it's a really tough one. At the start of the season, I had absolutely no doubts at all that they would, but... I think, City have obviously won the league already, so we can forget about them. United and Chelsea possibly for second and third, and I honestly wouldn't like to call it now. They've got as good an opportunity as Arsenal to get there, but I don't know. I'm going to sit firmly on the fence.
I think Liverpool will finish. I don't think Spurs or Arsenal will make it.
No, Liverpool, yeah, of course.
Yeah. Now, I've been involved with a documentary on youth football called No Hunger in Paradise, transmitted last night. Thankfully, a huge response to it. The viewers and listeners of this podcast have come up with quite a few good questions. I'd just like to spend, if we can, a few minutes just looking at what is a really important subject because it deals with the future of the game. Tom Pedrick, he said, look, I've just watched Wenger explain in the film how hard it is to bring young players into the side when there's so much pressure for success. At the same time, I'm seeing Arsenal fans on social media tweeting that they're outraged that he's fielded a weakened team against Forest. Does that prove his point for him?
Yeah, he's got a very good point there. I think there's a slight difference about putting youngsters into a weakened team. There weren't that many youngsters in that team. There were maybe three into a weakened team. I remember City, they really gave up on the Cup a couple of years ago. Chelsea got beat 5-1. They put a whole youth team out pretty much. And that doesn't do the kids any good, I don't think. Even though there were a lot of experienced players in that Arsenal team, but it wasn't a full-strength team, trying to blub one or two in a full-strength side is going to do a lot more for their confidence and allow them to find their feet. But Wenger's clearly one of the managers, and Pochettino's an outstanding example of it, who are keen... to blood youngsters. There's become a bit of a sort of coward's charter amongst Premier League managers where they would just, if they think a player might be good enough, they'll send him out on loan for a season and see if he can do it. A top club in the Premier League will send one out to a lower Premier League club to see if they can do it in the Premier League. And Mourinho, would certainly fit that bill. He's done that at Chelsea. Let someone else take the flak if they don't make it. And they have no risk on themselves then, is there? So, I get the point. It's a good point. But I think maybe the Forest example wasn't the best one.
Mm. Chris Atkinson, he said he found it really interesting that Gareth Southgate in the film disagreed with clubs taking players at such a young age. Do you agree with that?
I do, yeah. I know there's a huge divide from the professional game and us talking or me ever saying, or when I played Sunday morning football. But, I don't think I started playing until I was sort of 9 and 10. And even then, we weren't really ready. It was only when you're sort of 11 that you can actually kick the ball far enough for it to get to the, the corner flag. And I walk past parks where I live and you see children's games being organised for like 5-year-olds and 6-year-olds. I just think it's too early for them. I just think that's the time when children should be playing in school playgrounds and, just amongst themselves, but not necessarily in such a controlled environment. So I agree, and I mean Gareth Southgate was absolutely right. How on earth can you spot a Premier League player at 7 years old? It's just a nonsense. I mean, I played cricket to a reasonable standard when I was younger, and the lads who did go on to make it, Jimmy Ormond was one who went on to play for Surrey and obviously for England. You wouldn't have said probably at 14 or 15 that he was going to be the one who made it out of the 18, 19 lads that we were playing with. He was probably 5th, 6th, 7th in the pecking order, and yet he was the one who made the most of his ability. And I know people, some children will be outstanding at 7 and then probably keep going, but I just think it's way too early.
The money in the game influencing it. You've got Owen Mayers. He's basically saying, look, we really got to restrict the age at which players can be signed. We've got to support them when they fall out of the system. But realistically, are we going to see that?
Probably not. I mean, they are, you know, young players who don't make it, which is, as you said very right in an excellent documentary, it's you know, it's well over 99% of them, 99.9% of them, I think, will not make it. For the, it's like difficult for the game to support them properly. You'd hope that the bigger clubs, particularly, would have people there that might give, you know, kids are going to need a certain amount of guidance, counselling, even whatever. You know, if your dream that you've been you know, your life's been, you feel you've been going towards for the previous, for as long as you can remember, basically, is then suddenly pulled away from you at the age of 16. It can be very, very traumatic, clearly. Mm. How much realistically the game can do to solve that particular problem, you know, it's a tough one. But you do hear a lot of managers saying now that they try and improve young kids as human beings as well as footballers, so therefore they are, you know, some of the work they may have done in an academy system might help them in another job if they don't happen to make it as a professional footballer.
I think it's with the parents, Mike. You know, I think the clubs have more of a responsibility to educate the parents. They don't clubs don't have a responsibility to, you know, go off and look after every child that didn't make it. Every industry, you know, people have faced rejection and it hasn't worked out for them. It's just part of life. But I think the parents have to be educated better so that they can be the people who provide the support network for children who, you know, who perhaps have had their hearts broken and make sure that they can bounce back and say, look, yeah, you haven't made it, but there's so much else out there in the world. There are other ways to get involved with the game. You know, it doesn't have to just be a player going. Do a, you know, a sports science degree and become a physio, so you're working within that environment. Go and, you know, as Vincent Kompany's done, go and do your MBA so you can get into the hierarchy of a football club, become the team, you know, secretary, something like that. So I think that's where the onus has to lie. Mm.
The guys at Youth Hawk, which is a very, very good website for youth football, they say, should we demand more of the PFA in providing proactive aftercare and support for players who are released?
Yeah, I mean, we probably should. And as we well know about the PFA, the one thing we know about the PFA is they're awash with money, and they're, you know, the richest. You know, and Gordon Taylor is the richest.
Yeah, does football get value for that money?
No, I don't think it does. No, and I think you know, you would hope that they would provide, you know, some, you know, better education for those, you know, and maybe, you know, guidance for that, for those kids who don't make it. Yeah, I think that should certainly be part of the PFA's role.
I disagree with that, actually, because I think that the, you know, the PFA stands for Professional Footballers Association, so they are there to provide for professional players during their playing days and after their playing days. But I think if you're released at 16, I think maybe another body needs to be made.
Yeah, well, there's a body called the Players Trust, which is, you know, a not-for-profit organisation which provides free counselling. Yeah, I can see
absolutely
that.
Yeah. Maybe the clubs, the Football League and the Premier League need to get all their clubs together and put a you know, like you say, a body like that in place, so the aftercare is there for the parents. But yeah, I actually don't think, I know the PFA take a bit of a kick in on a lot of issues, and I don't think this is one that they really need to worry too much about.
You certainly highlighted the parenting issue in that documentary, and that is, you know, it's scary in many ways, you know, the pressure that parents can put their kids under, and just and the way that they live vicariously through their kids, and that is, you know, and that's always been the case to some extent in youth football when I was a kid, but you know, now with the amount of money, and it is just like you say, just getting one professional contract is like winning the lottery. Yeah. That it's very difficult to try and manage that.
And
you really would hope that clubs would try and educate those parents who need educating.
I thought the AD Boothroyd, line, and it was absolutely brilliant, superb. Line. You know, you wouldn't shout at a youngster learning to read, so why would you shout at a youngster learning to play football? I mean, just epitomised the whole documentary for me.
Well, the talent's there. It just needs time and room to breathe. Thanks for joining us here on the Football Writers Podcast.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.